From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We're going to spend the hour today talking with Dr. Ali Khan. Dr. Khan, welcome to the program. I wonder if you might just start us off by reading something from us. It's a passage from a book that you wrote a couple of years ago.
Greetings, Meghna. The time has come for us to move beyond seeing public health as an axe in the display case, where the sign says, in case of emergency, break glass, and into the realm of flame retardant building materials with fire extinguishers and sprinkler systems. In other words, we need to build preventive measures directly into the infrastructure of our communities and make them resilient. Doing so is dependent on gathering accurate data that helps us identify the underlying causes of problems, develop effective preventive measures, and monitor progress as these measures are implemented to improve health in our communities. These are the choices we make. And we will see if Louis Pasteur was right when he said, gentlemen, it is the microbes who will have the last word.
So that is from your book, The Next Pandemic, On the Front Lines Against Humankind's Gravest Dangers, which you wrote in 2016, right?
Correct.
Okay.
After 20, 30 years of following these outbreaks all over the world.
You put together the summation of that experience in this book, and it's called The Next Pandemic. So here we are in 2020, in the midst of the next pandemic. Dr. Khan, I have to ask, this metaphor of seeing public health as the axe in the display case, where the sign says, in case of emergency, break glass. Do you feel like our response to the novel coronavirus has not even been to pick up the axe in a timely way, that instead we stood in front of the display case and sort of primped our hair a little and then looked at the axe and wondered what it was for?
I guess you have taken the metaphor to all the way to the final conclusion. Yeah. So I have characterized this as a lack of imagination. But I think that's really unfair, sort of in terms of thinking that I had some unique insight into this outbreak. If you look at the original identification of the first cases in the United States at the end of January, South Korea also had their initial case into their country at the exact same time, and they took a completely different approach. So they rapidly scaled up testing, and they had that data. And that was in my passage, I talk about data. Data is the lifeblood of what we do in public health, because it helps you understand what's going on. And so they had the data to approach the outbreak very differently, and they had a very different outcome from their outbreak. And we did not approach the outbreak the same way the South Koreans and other countries approached their outbreak. And we find ourselves now at this point where, despite the initial, our initial response was not as robust as it could have been. But I will take you through, if you want to follow the same metaphor, to today. So we are now approximately 4 to 5 weeks past our peak of 35,000 cases a day, 35,000 cases a day. And 4 to 5 weeks past that peak, we're still seeing 20,000 cases a day. Mm. So individuals are worried about the next peak in the fall. And I say we're still surfing the current peak, because public health still doesn't have the resources and support to do what they need to be doing about getting these cases down.
Yeah. So I'll continue with this metaphor. The axe that public health should have been, maybe we used that axe and broke the glass, but the axe is pretty dull from, it's not sharp as sharp as it needed to be from many years of neglect. Now, listen, Dr. Khan, we have had many deeply knowledgeable people on this show in the past couple of months. And I want to tell folks specifically why we invited you today, because your experience is pretty profound. So Dr. Khan is right now, he's the dean of the College of Public Health and a professor of epidemiology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, one of the premier centers regarding infectious diseases. And before that, he spent a couple of decades at the CDC including as director of the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response, a position he held from 2010 to 2014, and prior to that, as deputy director of the National Center for Zoonotic, Vector-Borne, and Enteric Diseases. So you know a lot about viruses and emerging infectious diseases. I would love it if you could take us back to the period where this country, this world, I should say, had an opportunity to learn a lot from a previous coronavirus, because I want to have you unpack the story of your experience with SARS. So SARS emerged, what, first in 2002, late 2002, early 2003. You ended up going to Singapore to help the Singaporean government. First of all, when did you get the call that there was this new respiratory disease that was quite worrisome?
So the SARS 2002-2003 outbreak actually matches very nicely and mirrors what we saw with this current outbreak with COVID-19, which is caused by SARS coronavirus 2. So emerged in China in somewhere around October, November, December. For SARS, a infected healthcare worker showed up in Hong Kong. And then from that individual then seeded infection around the world. And so we recognized the disease and has these cases showed up in Vietnam and Singapore and other countries. And so I was involved in the outbreak immediately as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was notified of these cases. And then as the cases started to spiral up in Singapore through our work with WHO, I was invited to come and assist the Ministry of Health in Singapore, investigate their outbreak and think through what their prevention and control strategies needed to look like in Singapore.
Okay, so when you first arrived in Singapore in March of 2003, what was the mood amongst public health officials in Singapore? Was there a sense as to how dangerous the SARS outbreak was?
Yes, there was a sense of how dangerous the SARS outbreak was. So there was a lot that was unknown about the virus at that time. And you mentioned it earlier in your opening conversation. So the disease was quite deadly. It's 10 to 15% of people were dying. The current COVID-19, most of those deaths were occurring amongst hospitalized patients, and it was spreading silently amongst hospitalized patients. So it was skipping from hospital to hospital. So there was significant uncertainty about this disease and where it was spreading throughout that community. So I arrived in the midst of all that uncertainty of how do you track this disease throughout the community and how do you sort of get it under control?
And take us into the room. I mean, you met, what, daily, right, with Ministry of Health officials in Singapore trying to craft a plan on how to control this outbreak. Can you tell us what that was like?
Intense would be the word. Fortunately, Singapore has an excellent public health system, extremely competent, well-trained, well-educated clinicians and public health practitioners who rapidly set up a system to identify cases and isolate individuals who are infected. They put together a response that involved the clinicians, obviously, people who worked on the laboratory side of the house, that involved the local law enforcement authorities to identify individuals had they needed to identify them, social welfare entities, and their technology industry, believe it or not, because they did some innovative things around putting people into quarantine and checking up on them if they were in quarantine. So they would call them twice a day and verify that they were at home. So it was a whole of society response that I saw unfold over a couple of months to try to identify all of these individuals. And they were committed from day one that there was a containment and elimination strategy. And they stuck to it regardless of the setbacks they had when all of a sudden they saw cases in the community that they didn't expect. But, you know, they just plowed through it and they just kept on sticking with their strategy. And eventually they were successful and they got each and every last case taken care of.
But there's something really critical here that maybe maybe because you do this day in and day out, you just unintentionally glossed over. In Singapore, when it was decided that one of the best ways to control SARS would be to isolate and quarantine people, we actually hadn't seen a lot of that in a large scale for a long time, right? I mean, we have had conversations on this show a couple of months ago where we've had experts say, well, mass quarantine prior to the past couple of outbreaks wasn't something that we considered for, you know, a century. So I read a quote from you in that you told another journalist that you said it had kind of gone out of vogue. So how did it come back into vogue in Singapore?
It had completely gone out of vogue. But they recognized that SARS, the original SARS, was essentially a version of Ebola or monkeypox. These are animal-borne diseases. So a reminder for your listeners who are very astute and knowledgeable at this point with all your experts. So these viruses, and you talked about my resume of working in zoonotic diseases, One Health work. So these viruses are animal-borne viruses. That's their natural host all the time. And occasionally they spill over into humans. And for the most part, even though they cause person-to-person transmission, if you have a robust public health response, you can chase them back into the wild again. And that was the approach that was always, that was the approach that was taken with SARS. And so the Singaporeans recognized that, and they took this isolation of cases and quarantine of contacts approach, and they brought it back out and they updated it for the 21st century. So they used technological tools to identify who all the cases were within hospitals, for example, or if you got infected if they thought that you were in a taxi cab, they went through receipts and, you know, your credit cards to see who went in and out of the taxi cab or who went in and out of the market. And that's how they found cases. That's how they found contacts. And then when they eventually...
Well, Dr. Khan, if you forgive me, I'm going to have to actually just interrupt for one second because we have to take a quick break. But there's so much more to this story that I want to hear when we come back. So stand by for just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Dr. Ali Khan. He's Dean of the College of Public Health and a professor of epidemiology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Prior to that, he served as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. And he was deputy acting director of the National Center for Zoonotic, Vector-Borne, and Enteric Diseases, amongst many positions he held at the CDC for quite some time. Dr. Khan has been around the world chasing viruses and trying to tamp out outbreaks. And we want to learn from his experience about why we took the missteps in this country that we did with the novel coronavirus outbreak. Now, Dr. Khan, you were telling us about your experience in 2003 in Singapore and how the detail with which the Singaporean government decided to basically do it. You were effectively talking about contact tracing down to looking at receipts from taxi drivers.
Receipts from taxi drivers, looking at their credit card statements. And then once they quarantined people, how they had updated it again for the 21st century, they would put cameras in people's homes and randomly call them in the morning and the evenings and then that would give them a certain time window to connect to the webcam and make sure that they were there. So they updated everything for the 21st century. Well, I guess at that point it was the 20th century to make sure that quarantine and isolation measures, and they were effective. They were very effective. And they got their outbreak under control. But the bigger point, besides updating isolation and quarantine was that they stuck to their strategy despite the setbacks they had during the course of that outbreak, with these unexpected cases occurring in markets and taxi cabs and other places.
Okay. So as with so many of the conversations that I've had in the past couple of months, we have the luxury of looking back, right, on history. But I'm wondering if you could actually put us squarely in terms of what you were thinking and feeling in that moment in 2003 when you were in Singapore. Was there ever a time where you were wondering if the efforts that you were helping with, like, would they work? Wouldn't they work? Were there moments of uncertainty?
Oh, absolutely. There were numerous moments of uncertainty. So when I got there, the moments of uncertainty resolved around how do you identify who infected whom within hospitals? SARS coronavirus 1, you became more infectious as you became as you progressed in your illness. So that disease was mainly transmitted within healthcare settings. So there was a challenge to try to understand who you were infecting within the hospital. So there was uncertainty there that we could capture everybody who was sick, because then you had to go look for all the visitors into the hospital. Then if you left the hospital and went to another hospital. So eventually, the Singaporean authorities did a great job of tracking that down. Then the next big point of uncertainty came when we saw this large number of cases that occurred in a market that was completely unexpected with no link back to additional cases. That's what we would call community transmission, would be the term that people would recognize. And that was very disheartening. But again, the Singaporean public health authorities just worked right through it and said, okay, we're going to take each and every one of these cases, find their contacts, and keep going about our business. And they did. And despite the uncertainty, and I remember that day, it was very disheartening for everybody. But a couple of weeks later, they got all of those under control again. And those days, when I thought about, now in retrospect, I think about that day in Singapore with all those cases. I'm sure that's how my friends in South Korea felt when they opened up South Korea a couple of weeks ago, and then they had one individual who caused about 200 cases around 5 nightclubs. Uh-huh. So I'm sure they felt the exact same way when all of a sudden they thought they were on the right track and they had this, blossoming of cases around a single individual.
Wow. So there's so many details about this SARS experience that you had that we could dive into, but I am constrained by time, Dr. Khan. So let's fast forward a tiny bit. You helped the Singaporean government in the midst of that SARS outbreak. You saw the successes that they had in 2003. You come back to the United States. You're at the CDC at this time. Did you come back and say, wow, we learned a whole lot, and here's what we need to do in the United States? What do you think the most important lessons were that you learned that you wanted the U.S. to vigorously incorporate in terms of its public health responses to emerging diseases?
So one of the main lessons we learned during the SARS outbreak, so let me go through some of them. So the SARS outbreak was one of the best reminders we ever had, was about how air travel can rapidly move disease worldwide. And this all has to do with this wonderful thing called an incubation period. And the incubation period, which almost every movie ignores, is the time you get infected to the time you manifest disease. And this incubation period always protected us when you needed to get on a boat to go from point A to point B, because by the time you got to wherever you were going, you knew you were infected. That doesn't work with airplanes, because the time it takes to fly from London to New York is less than the time it takes for you to sort of incubate that disease. So you can show up in New York City from Milan and then 3 days later manifest your disease. So the SARS outbreak made that very clear and taught us a lot about what it means to screen people at borders, because you're not going to pick up everybody because of this incubation period. It also taught us something about super spreading events. which is this sort of, even though we talk about this COVID-19 causing maybe 2 to 3 additional cases for each individual, there are some individuals where you can see 15, 20, 50, 100 cases around that individual. These are called super spreading events. Those are very problematic in this disease and need to be considered as you think about mass gathering and other events and what the implications of those are. And it told us we need to be careful about thinking about these diseases generally, because there wasn't just SARS. There's also another related disease called MERS in the Arabian Peninsula that has proved problematic for them, and they've had cases in South Korea of MERS. So, and then the other piece is this robust public health response that's required by countries and globally.
Right.
So those were the lessons that we took away from that outbreak that we try to bake into our system. So one of my last jobs at CDC was ensuring that the U.S. was prepared for all public health threats, whether they were natural or man-made. And we try to incorporate that into our planning processes. But going back to the acts in the display case, we have always funded public health and preparedness with cents on the dollars compared to our healthcare. Mm-hmm. And we see that playing out now, which is that we have failed to fully support and fund CDC and state and local public health departments.
Yeah. Well, so Dr. Khan, I keep thinking about the book that you wrote, The Next Pandemic, in 2016. And you go into a lot of detail about not just what you learned, for example, regarding SARS, but you have basically what amounts to a list of the things that we needed to do or must continuously do, not just occasionally, but continuously do to be ready for these kinds of global disasters. And the reason, though, I don't mean to laugh because this is not funny, but it almost, maybe that's just like my kind of reaction of disbelief. When I read the list of things that you were writing about years ago, right? Monitoring of actually viruses in the field, in the wild, if we can. Systems to produce diagnostic tests very fast and in huge numbers. Surge capacity in our healthcare system. Smarter supply chains for PPE, ventilators, etc. Coordination from local, state, federal, international level. I mean, it's like a list of all of the things, you could check them off, of the things that did not happen in 2020. So you talk about a failure of imagination. I mean, is it more, that almost seems a little generous. Is it more that we had that we went through a deliberate act of ignorance from our own experience?
We clearly have, despite a long history of emerging infectious diseases and pandemics. So, 2007, 2009, we had the H1N1 pandemic. So we've had experiences with emerging infectious diseases and a mild to moderate influenza pandemic in the U.S., we have failed to take those lessons to heart to make sure we build robust public health systems. And the comment about healthcare systems is spot on. One of the things that I had the honor of helping put together while I was at CDC with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation was a numeric metric of how prepared the United States was. And one of the lowest indicators in that was healthcare system preparedness. Mm. And the thing that got us in trouble with this outbreak was healthcare system preparedness. Right. So it's not like we didn't know where the weaknesses were that needed to be fixed that would have helped us during this outbreak.
Well, so I was just digging through some older through the Robert Wood Johnson website, because of the work that you had done with them. And it's really, really interesting because I think back in 2013, in the summer of 2013, they had sponsored a congressional briefing that you attended. And at that time, you had said, by every measure, our nation is dramatically better prepared for public health threats than they were. And you outlined some things that were going on in CDC that showed that stronger public health preparedness. What changed between then and now?
Oh, I don't think anything changed. I mean, every year our preparedness has improved in the U.S. The problem is the level of preparedness has never gotten to a 10. So our current preparedness in the U.S. is like a 6.7 on the numerical scale we developed. So we had gone up, I think, from like 6.3 to 6.4 to 6.5 over the years I was there. So we were making incremental baby step changes and improving our systems, but we still had a long way to go. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And thank you for that clarification, because it's, I suppose, the reason why I asked you that, Dr. Khan, is for someone like you and your colleagues, your current colleagues in Nebraska, former colleagues at the CDC, you know, current colleagues worldwide who are in the world of epidemiology and infectious diseases. Do you feel a sense of frustration, heartbreak now about how we still had a long ways to go in preparedness, and even though we knew how to get there as a nation, this nation, we didn't do it?
Well, it's impossible not to feel a sense of frustration. There's 90,000 Americans who have died so far. So you have to feel a sense of frustration and heartbreak at what's happened. I mean, each and every one of those is a tragic death. And it's not, you know, you don't know what could or would have happened, especially given hindsight. But yes, there is a sense of frustration. And, you know, I know even during my time at CDC that, you know, while there was lots of support for preparedness activities following 9/11, some additional support when there was concern about potential avian influenza outbreak in 2005, 2006, and 2007. You know, when there's not this looming threat directly there, you know, dollars fall off to supply, to support preparedness activities in state and local health departments. And also state and local officials have responsibility to support their own state and local health departments. So I hope, if nothing else, people realize that they need to do this, and not just for the next pandemic, even for this current pandemic, we need to strengthen our public health departments to help us get these cases down into the teens.
Yeah. About CDC, though, what do you make of how it seems to have, it's now absent as an important public face of our response to COVID-19. What do you make of that?
So, Meghna, that's a really good question. So there's no doubt that CDC made some characteristic missteps early in this outbreak, both strategic, operational, and political. But that said, they've actually recognized them, which is what CDC does, right? It's a learning organization. They will become stronger for it. But I can tell you, I see the work of CDC every day. They are the most brilliant public health scientists, not just in the US, but worldwide. You see their guidance. It's excellent. They're in the States working every day. And I saw something from Dr. Redfield the other day, who's the director of CDC, talking about the second wave and what that would look like. And I'm like, there you go. There's the excellent CDC science reminding us that nothing has, or very little has, changed from January, right? So yes, we're reopening America, but the virus is still out there. And instead of 100% of people being susceptible, now 95% are susceptible. And here's the director of CDC reminding us of that and what we need to do to make sure that we're careful about this second wave. So there you go, CDC science on display.
Well, so if I may, Dr. Khan, I mean, you worked at the CDC for many, many years. And I'm leaning on your experience to help us get more insight about this really critical agency right now, because just today in The Atlantic, there was The Atlantic magazine's published a story where they say the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is conflating the results of two different types of coronavirus tests, which is distorting important metrics and providing an inaccurate picture of the state of the pandemic. The Atlantic says they've learned that the CDC is making a mistake, combining test results that diagnose current coronavirus infections with test results that measure whether someone has ever had the virus. So I guess antibody tests. We've just got about a minute before we have to take the next break, but I want to ask you, how is it that something like this could happen at the CDC?
So, sorry, Meghna, I haven't seen the article, okay. So it's hard to comment on it, but it depends in what context. So antibody tests play a role in trying to tell you how many people likely were infected. And depending on how you estimate that, you would also look at people who had PCR positive tests, which would have told you how many people had active infection. So without having read the article, it's kind of hard to judge it.
Yeah, fair enough. So Dr. Ali Khan, stand by for just a second. We have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Dr. Ali Khan. He is Dean of the College of Public Health and a Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Prior to that, he was Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. He was also Deputy and Acting Director of the National Center for Zoonotic, Vector-Borne, and Enteric Diseases. And he spent a career, several decades, in fact, traveling the world from outbreak to outbreak almost, trying to help control and push back emerging infectious diseases. So he's got a lot of experience that we're trying to learn from this hour. Dr. Khan, let's step way, way, way back here. I'm curious, what is it about viruses that you find so fascinating, that you love so much, that you've dedicated your entire career to studying?
Okay, so this may sound strange, but I may be one of the few people who collectively think that they're intelligent, that they have a purpose in trying to figure out how do we find a new host or how do we propagate and the ingenious ways they go about it. So I've always found that very interesting. And I think that's why I've always sort of been pulled toward these zoonotic diseases and the various approaches these zoonotic diseases take to spill over into humans. And then once they spill over into humans, how they go about trying to find a new host.
So on the one hand, for any great lover of science, I suppose it doesn't actually sound that strange, Dr. Khan, because,
okay.
because you can define, you know, at its base, what life does. I mean, even what DNA and RNA does is whether, even though it might be through the magic of randomness, that it probes. What was it that was said in Jurassic Park? Life finds a way. But when
exactly.
when you use intelligence as a word, that's one that kind of raises a question. I mean, you're not actually ascribing any like intelligence, recognizable intelligence to it. Are you just using that as a way to describe life finding a way?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So you and Jeff Goldblum got it. This drive to understand how viruses probe their environments and jump from species to species, then into humans, and then spread and mutate. That has taken you around the world to different outbreaks. So you did a lot of work on Ebola, right?
Correct. Ebola is one of those diseases that I've worked on, but lots of others, Congo Crimean hemorrhagic fever, Rift Valley fever, monkeypox, others.
Yeah. Did you have any close calls in any of those journeys?
So occasionally, so, you know, some of these diseases, for example, Rift is spread by mosquitoes, Congo Crimean hemorrhagic fever spread by ticks, and I would be in environments where I could potentially have gotten infected. Similarly for Ebola, when I've tended to patients. However, my whole job is to convince communities and clinicians how they can take care of patients and protect themselves without getting infected. So it would have been very poor form for me to get infected.
Right.
And so I was always careful to not get infected, because my job there when I arrive is to help people understand how these diseases are transmitted and to protect themselves.
Right.
So I would have seen that as a sign of not doing what I'm supposed to do.
Well, and so in addition to that, one of the truths about infectious diseases is that the outbreaks are oftentimes exacerbated by other factors in the human societies where the outbreak's occurring, right? Whether it's poverty, war, other kinds of instability. Have you ever been in places where it was those other forms of human instability that made outbreaks worse?
So, Meghna, if you ever have the opportunity to come and take my emerging infection course, I will tell you that political factors are the predominant reason that emerging infectious diseases are a problem. This outbreak is a good example that politics played the major factor after the initial disease emergence. The public health systems are political constructs. They're not a function of the original virus emergence. And so very well said. I do remember when I was doing I was helping with the guinea worm eradication in southern Sudan, and I got called from CDC because they were worried about something going on in western Sudan some rampaging and people dying there. And I said, nope, no worries. I'm at no risk of being killed in western Sudan, because I'm down here in southern Sudan being surrounded by 16-year-olds armed with AK-47, so I'm safe as can be. So, yeah, I've been in some interesting places during the course of my career.
Including trapped between Laurent Kabila's guerrillas and the forces of President Mobutu, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We called the American embassy and they told us, no worries, the most they'll do is just take everything you have and leave you there. And we thought that may not be the best alternative for us. And we ended up fleeing with our samples. It's interesting where you find yourself when you're trying to stamp out disease.
So, and yet now you find yourself in Omaha, Nebraska, your home.
Absolutely, love it.
The pandemic has come to you.
The pandemic has come to me, and it's been interesting to see how this pandemic plays out in the U.S., including how it's been playing out here in the heartland, where initially they had not seen a lot of cases, but where we now have seen issues around meatpacking plants, for example, and obviously also in long-term care facilities.
Okay. Can I just ask you, what really differentiates the response that you've seen here from what we frequently judge with Western eyes as a disorganized, incompetent response in other countries, like war-torn countries, to public health disasters? What really differentiates it?
What differentiates our response?
Right now. Yeah. Because it feels like we frequently in the West look upon, okay, I'll take the African examples that we gave. It's easy for us to pass judgment and say, well, it's a war-torn country, economically depressed, they don't have the infrastructure, the chaos. Therefore, there's chaos. But here, not war-torn, wasn't economically depressed, had the infrastructure, more or less, and still chaos. So really, what differentiates the responses?
I would say nothing. I would say none of us were prepared for what happened, including many of these Western countries. The United States is a good example. The European countries are good examples. And what I look at as the best examples on this response would be China, New Zealand, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, I mean, those are examples of excellent responses, and they stuck to a containment strategy, and they had excellent, you know, whole of government leadership from day one. And so you're right. I just differentiate based on who has the least number of cases every day. Mm. That's how I look at a response.
Right.
It's based on the outcome. And I look at who has the best outcomes. And the countries that have the best outcomes are many of these Asian countries.
Yeah. So, Dr. Khan, I'm curious what you think about this. I've been turning this over in my head for a while now. It's not as if the United States in the past hasn't been willing to make major investments in different kinds of preparedness, right? I mean, for example, all the way down at the individual level, we require people to buy insurance, right? Whether it's health insurance or homeowners insurance, that kind of thing. The whole insurance industry exists to mitigate risk. At the largest level, we spend trillions of dollars to fund the United States military. We spent half a century spending money and considerable energy and intelligence building up a nuclear arsenal as the form of ultimate insurance against the risk of mutually assured destruction. So we can do this. What is it about public health that we don't see it, or at least infectious disease prevention, that we don't see it in that same through that same lens?
And we need to see it through that same lens, which is why I started using the word health security many years ago when I was at CDC. So it's an interesting juxtaposition now. So I have always framed these infectious diseases, as tragic as they are from lives lost and ill people, the economic, social, and political outcomes can greatly dwarf that. And we see this playing out now. So we see these multi-trillion dollar losses occurring to economies worldwide, when if you go back into the last year, if somebody had asked for a few hundred million to $1 billion for preparedness, the answer would have been no. And you go, wait, that makes no sense. And today it would make no sense, right? If you knew about, you know, COVID-19 coming, you'd be like, take all the trillions of dollars, billions of dollars you want to prepare, so we don't have to spend the trillions that would be necessary if we get this wrong. So hopefully people will be better prepared for the next pandemic, because this is a dress rehearsal for potentially the next pandemic. The deaths, tragic as they are not on the scale of a 1918 pandemic of influenza. So we do need to be ready still for the next pandemic.
I mean, in a sense, in the West, we have been very lucky, right? There have been some close calls. SARS was a really close near miss. I keep thinking about the 10%, 10 to 15% fatality rate with SARS. I mean, it's almost unimaginable what would have happened if that pandemic had spun fully out of control. But to get back to what you said a little earlier in this hour, Dr. Khan, you're still seeing the United States kind of bouncing around at 2,000 deaths per day, but we're having states also trying to pick up economic activity again, get back on their feet. So are they doing the right thing?
So, correct. So we're still bouncing around after 4 to 5 weeks at 20,000 cases a day, which is way too many. And yes, I don't think these are mutually exclusive. We can reopen, but we can reopen safely. But to reopen safely, you need to drop cases down in our communities. And what we want to have is the cases in the teens. All of the various tools and checklists about reopening talk about how many cases there are in the community, you know. And so the less cases, the safer people are to go out and about their business. So yes, you can reopen, but please reopen safely. And that's about public health again.
Right.
You know, sharpen that axe. Find those cases, find those contacts.
Right. And thank you, by the way. I misspoke when I said 2,000. You said 20,000 cases a day.
20,000 cases a day, yeah. Correct.
Dr. Khan, if I may, just yesterday you put out this tweet saying, can you clearly identify if your community has controlled substantial
yes.
community transmission? If not, then planning and precautions are merely theater.
Yes. So that's the point about doing this simultaneously. So I think this is where people need to hold their local and state officials accountable to say, what is community transmission look like that you're asking us to go out and about in my community? So yes, I want to be able to go to the grocery store. I want to send my kids back to school, but I want to send my kids back to school when I know they're least likely to get infected, and they're least likely to get infected if there's low community transmission. And that is on my state and local officials to guarantee me that low community transmission. This is COVID-19. This is not flu that's out there in the community that we can do nothing about. This is a disease that we know we can do something about and get down to low levels. And that was my point, that we need to be making sure that we're driving down transmission.
Driving down transmission. So, I mean, perhaps you've said this before this hour, but I'm going to ask you again directly. Right now, what should we be doing to continue to drive down that transmission?
Right now, we should be making sure we have enough testing capability in America to identify every case early, isolate that individual, identify that person's contacts, and put them in quarantine for 14 days. And that strategy has worked and continues to work in many countries worldwide to drive down transmission. And that makes it safer for you to go out and about your business and do everything you want to do.
So essentially, we should be doing what you saw and helped the Singaporean government do in 2003.
Exactly. And what the Chinese and the New Zealanders are doing today in Taiwan.
I suppose I come back to this again and again. There must be something about human beings or human systems that while we have times of extreme collective intelligence, we also have times of extreme collective ignorance. And I'm trying to figure out, puzzle my way, how do we get out of this collective ignorance that we have right now? Especially if, to stretch your metaphor of viral intelligence, I mean, we read that passage from your book at the beginning of Pasteur saying, microbes who will have the last word. We can't let the microbes have the last word, can we, Dr. Khan?
Absolutely not. We're smarter. And even though they have the ability to multiply multiple times per day, we are very ingenious, and we do know they have only so many strategies to infect us, and we will continue to think of new ways to protect ourselves. But that's about making the appropriate choices. And that was part of that passage too. We need to make the appropriate choices about our systems to protect us. And that starts today to say that this disease is not inevitable in our communities. And that's why every time I hear about this second wave, I go, this is not inevitable. We have a choice to make here to drive down transmission in our communities and protect our individuals as they go out and about their days.
Well, Dr. Ali Khan is Dean of the College of Public Health and a Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He spent a couple of decades before that at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, including as Director of the CDC's Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. Dr. Khan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Meghna. This was a delight of a conversation.
And thank you for doing all the work that you've been doing and for sounding the clarion call as loudly as you have. And by the way, folks, tomorrow, speaking of opening up, we're going to be looking ahead to the summer and the prospect of Major League Baseball returning to a ballpark near you. What do you think about that? Send us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.